Welcome to the RSP Cast. This is Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. We are in week 15 of the Quick Game with Mark Schofield. Mark, always a pleasure to do this show with you.
Yeah, Matt. This one's always a blast. It's what I always look forward to. Every, you know, it's usually Tuesday, the questions come in, and I get a little chance to get myself organized, some notes down. But this is like the two-minute drill that this is kind of named after. Things can go in a different direction, and I think we might see that today. But I'm always excited, always great to be with you, always great to catch up before these shows, and excited to dive in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we like to, we may zig where people expect us to zag at this point. Normally, if you've caught this, if you're a new subscriber or a new listener to the RSP Cast, you know, listen, this format is set up in a way where I post a bunch of questions for Mark and he and I to answer, and we give ourselves, you know, a minute time limit to answer them. And then we have a little bit of a buzzer. We're kind of lax about doing it, but occasionally we enforce it. And then we have a three timeouts that we can use during the time that we do this podcast to take 3 minutes to answer those questions. So that's kind of the format with this, so that we try and keep things crisp and go from there. So we're going to get right into it. And the first question, Mark, for you is that, talk about Denver Broncos' Drew Lock, who's delivered a strong two-game NFL debut. What have you seen, and what do you hope to see in the future?
Yeah, I've been very impressed with him. And, you know, anytime you see sort of a young quarterback have some success, your immediate thoughts go to where were they coming out? And one of the things with Lock that I thought was a developing part of his game, but it was still a work in progress, was the idea of the anticipation throw, where you've got to make the quick decision and you've got to throw a receiver open. And it was something that he was trying to do at Missouri's final year. But if you think back to where he was initially at Missouri with a lot of stuff to the boundary, they were basically running like Baylor's offense where everything was a go route or a hitch route or a slant. You didn't see him attack in the middle of the field. And then I see him on their opening possession, I think, against Houston in the red zone, throwing a seam route to split the safeties of a cover two, red two look. We've got the underneath linebacker running with Noah Fant, and he's got to sort of throw him open over the middle of the field, which is a club he didn't really have developed yet, didn't really have it in his bag. I see that, and I think, look, he's piecing it together. And, you know, I've been impressed with throws like that. I've been impressed with the process and speed. The second touchdown he threw, another quick game concept where he gets the ball out of his hands quickly. I've been impressed with that. What I really sort of want to see is the footwork part. And I know we say, I've said mechanics don't matter until they matter. He still relies on arm strength and making these fadeaway throws, and it can work for him at times, but it's not always going to work. I want to see the footwork get better.
Yeah, and I think that I'll pick up where you left off with that, is that, you know, to explain, you know, maybe in more detail about the footwork, is that when he, because he has such a strong arm, he's gotten away during his career in high school and in Missouri of being able to throw off platform. But there's more to it, off platform and off balance, because Patrick Mahomes generally makes a lot of off platform throws. But if you notice, he's always upright. You know, it's like his feet are under his hips and shoulders, and they're aligned even when he's off the ground. When you look at even if he's turning, you know, in the opposite direction and throwing against the grain, his feet are still aligned with his shoulders. When Drew Lock throws off platform, his feet might be like way out in front of his body, way beside of his body, or way behind his body, in a way where you're wondering how he's going to maintain his balance when his feet do hit the ground. Or is it going to be his knees that hit the ground, or his ass that hits the ground first when he leaves his feet like that? And when you don't have your base under you, that leads to a lack of velocity and accuracy. You're not being able to turn through your hips. So him being off platform and off balance is a bigger issue with that. But I agree with you, his footwork, his you know, his footwork on set drops, his decision-making, his confidence in being able to hit what he sees and anticipated has been great. He's reading the field pretty darn well. But I'll just add this real quick at the end of it, is that, you know, we have to remember when Romeo Crennel says they watched one game of Drew Lock, which was last week's game, that gives the defense an inherent advantage. An offense inherent advantage, because they don't really know what to expect from Lock, because they haven't looked at his weaknesses in college tape to translate to how they would game plan. And then the Denver's can add a couple new wrinkles that the Broncos have, I mean, that the Texans had never seen before because they only studied one game.
Right.
So this is why young quarterbacks do well in their first starts because of this kind of, I'll call it kind of limited process that defensive coordinators often use to study rookie quarterbacks.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points, especially that one game of tape. I mean, we always talk about, oh, now they've got film on Lamar Jackson or whatever. They had nothing on Drew Lock.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of film on Lamar Jackson, the Bills did a pretty good job of stopping him as a runner last week. You know, and I think that if the Bills offense didn't get overwhelmed by the Ravens defense, this could have been quite a game in terms of a chance for them to win this. And they have a shot now to win the division if they beat the Patriots this month. Do you think either AFC East contender has the goods to represent the AFC in February?
I think you'd have to give either Buffalo or New England a shot. Just in the sense that the AFC, other than Baltimore, doesn't really look great, you know? Baltimore obviously looks fantastic. Their defense is getting better week to week. Lamar Jackson and that offense, it is tailored perfectly to his skill set, and they're putting up points on teams like Buffalo, who has a good defense. But outside of Baltimore, Kansas City, yeah, they still look okay. Maybe Houston. You know, the thing that concerns me as a Patriots fan is the fact that you look at the other three teams that are leading the AFC divisions right now, Houston, Baltimore, and Kansas City, you've lost to all three. But then you have to take in the Bill Belichick factor, which is it's not often that you get Bill Belichick and you beat him twice in a year. Their offense, I think there's enough there where they could piece it together. The defense is obviously good enough, so I think New England still has its shot. And I think Baltimore, with the strides that we've seen from Josh Allen and what their defense can do, I mean, excuse me, with Buffalo, they could certainly make a run as well. And so I think it wouldn't shock me if Buffalo or New England made it to the Super Bowl. I don't think they're prohibitive favorites, either team, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, so I'm going to give the opposite answer. I'm going to say there's no shot for either of these teams, okay? And I love the answers you gave, but the reason I'm going to do this is one is that I'm going to play the fool who thinks that somehow Belichick's teams here don't have the goods to do what he wants them to do this year. And I know we've been through this folly year after year, and the Patriots tend to make fools out of views like mine that I'm about to give, and I've never given this view before, but the way I look at it is this: the Patriots offensive line isn't good. The Patriots can't seem to communicate. Tom Brady and his receivers can't seem to be on the same page unless it's Julian Edelman. And so when they can't make adjustments and Brady doesn't get wide open throws or even can't make complete passes to receivers who should make adjustments with blitzes, and they blitz heavily because offensive line can't pick it up, and they're just saying to Brady, we don't believe that your receivers are going to respond to you in the manner that they need to. And Chris Jones says to Brady halfway through a game, this game is over. You know, that tells me that defenses like the Chiefs, even the Steelers, the Bills, and the Ravens can basically stop this offense. And I think that the Bills are in a similar boat in the sense that they're a young offensive line. They only have one receiver of note in John Brown, who I think is a real damage, you know, real threat. And if you can blitz Josh Allen heavily, well, you get shades of old Josh Allen in ways that I don't think he can overcome when you put seven-man pressure, pressure from different sides, and give them heavy blitz looks. And I think the Steelers are the type of team that can do that type of work to confuse these two teams as well. So as much as I like where the Bills are going, as much as I respect Tom Brady and Julian Edelman and that defense, I think that these teams have too many teams in the AFC who can use this type of defense to cause a lot of problems that I don't think the either team has the personnel to execute a different game plan to overcome.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are all fair points. I mean, the offense isn't good right now, especially New England's. And whether they figure it out in time, or at least get to a competent enough level. Time is running out. They have a chance for a get right game against Cincinnati this week, but you know, they'll face Buffalo in a couple of weeks, and that game suddenly looms massive.
Yeah, that should be a fun game, actually. I'm looking forward to watching that one. You know, we'll, I think we're ever feeling we'll be touching back on the Patriots right now, but I, but I, for right now, let's talk about something fun, which is which player did you most appreciate seeing included in the NFL 100 team thus far?
Yeah, and it's been fascinating to watch this unfold, and I know a lot of people, and we're going to talk about some omissions in a second, but I know a lot of people have sort of wondered about recency bias, or actually reverse recency bias. We're not seeing a lot of recent names being added to this list, so that's making people wonder about who's really putting it together. But a name that I was excited to see was Devin Hester, because you look at the way he could impact a game and the way he could take over a game and the way that, you know, you knew when he was back there that he had the chance to make something spectacular happen. You know, you sort of equate it to if, say, you're watching hockey and Alex Ovechkin gets the puck, you hold your breath, you expect something magical to happen. Back when Jordan was playing, or maybe now with LeBron, they get the ball in their hands, you expect something magical to happen. When Devin Hester is back there to receive a kick or a punt, you almost expect him to do something spectacular. And he opened a Super Bowl with a kick return. What everybody in the 2 weeks leading up to that Super Bowl thought, how is he going to impact this game? How are they going to even kick to him? And they do, and he houses it. So I was excited to see him on the list.
Yeah, and it's funny because my pick is the other return man, Billy White Shoes Johnson.
Okay, there you go.
So because growing up watching him, he was one of my absolute favorite players. And when you – you know, this was during an era where kickoffs and punts had different rules, and it was even wilder than it is now to return a kickoff or a punt. And while – and he was the type of player that not only was he good in that era as a returner and kickoff guy, but when he was with Atlanta and they used him as a wide receiver, there were a lot of magical moments with him. He was one of those guys that may not be statistically ever remotely worthy of a shot of being in the NFL 100 other than returns. But the way he played the game, he was one of those guys that was kind of like the fly in the ointment for opposing defenses, no matter what situation you put him in. And he was kind of ageless in the, you know, in terms of, there was even kind of speculation that he was much older than what he had stated.
Right.
So he was one of those players that you just kind of, he's a little more, he's like an urban legend, you know, in a certain sense. And so it made me feel good to see him on the team as a return specialist and that they remembered him. So who are, is there any glaring omission, you know, that you believe existed with this NFL 100? Who's the biggest one for you?
I mean, there are a couple of names that come to mind, but I think the biggest is Warren Sapp. And you look at that Tampa defense and sort of the way they, A, redefined the era. You know, that was when we were starting to get to a lot of 11 personnel. You were also seeing sort of tight ends, you know, have the ability to stretch the field and to attack the middle of the field. You know, you needed a counter to that, and that was the Tampa 2. And, you know, Derek Brooks was obviously a huge part of that. Tampa 2 wouldn't have been successful. Tony Dungy wouldn't have been kind of the household name if he didn't have a defender like that that could run with tight ends, that could run with slot receivers if necessary in that coverage scheme. But you also needed somebody up front that could get pressure with four, and Warren Sapp was a huge part of that. And if you look at now the reemergence of Tampa 2 and various similar coverage schemes, Derek Brooks and Warren Sapp had a big part to play in that defense now getting back into the fold in the National Football League. And that in the wins the Super Bowl, you know, I think Warren Sapp should have been on it. I don't know if there was some, again, recency bias of a sort, or some of his off the field stuff recently maybe played into that, but I thought Warren Sapp should have been on.
Yeah, I think that's he absolutely is deserving of being in that situation and being and having that opportunity to be on that team. And I agree with you that there is some recency bias there. And if anything, I think that a lot of these players who played before like 1950, if you have, you know, Dutch Clark, I'm sure Dutch Clark was a hell of a player, you know.
Right.
And by the way, you know, NFL.com, you know, or whoever's producing NFL films producing this, when you have the Bellustrator, please don't just show pictures of Bill Belichick standing there at the podium and you can't see the screen that you're trying to show. That's like the dumbest product direction that I've ever seen for, like, you want to see what the players are doing. We don't need to see Belichick up there telling you what's going on. Please don't dumb it down that much because you basically ruined the shot. So anyway, you know, to me, I just make it quick because you have, you know, these old players do a different team for players pre-1950 and just leave it there because there's too many changes to sit there and try and put them on there. Even if some of them deserve that they could play in any era. I love the attempt to do that, but don't leave LaDainian Tomlinson or Marshall Faulk off your running back roster for Dutch Clark, please. I'm sorry, but that's like, to me, that's crazy that those two guys didn't make it. They're fantastic players, and I think everyone who's listened to this has watched those guys enough to know that they belonged on that team.
Yeah.
So, really. So who's your latest draft crush from this class?
And let me preface this by saying that I have two, and one isn't really fair. But I just recently wrote about Chase Young from Ohio State and why the Giants would be silly to go the Todd McShay route of drafting a quarterback at two. I mean, this is a Chase Young no matter what situation. And I actually highlighted just three plays from the first quarter of his game against Wisconsin, a very good offensive line where on the first one, he stays home on a zone read type look and then still chases the running back down from behind. On the second one, they align him in a 2-point stance in the A gap. He blitzes, pressures the quarterback, comes to find out it's a running back screen, and he chases the running back down from behind for like a 1-yard gain. And then on the third, he blows up a double team, gets pressure on the quarterback. The quarterback spins away from him. He spins into a guy. The guy misses on the tackle. So what does Chase Young do? Drag the quarterback down from behind for a sack. And again, these were all in the first quarter. Now, Chase Young shouldn't be like a draft crush. But again, my focus is quarterbacks. So it's rare that I watch a defensive guy to begin with, but he just jumps off the tape. The other guy is Chenault, the wide receiver from Colorado. Been studying Steven Montez and seeing all the ways they get him involved in the game. Swiss Army knife type player. You can use him in the slot. You can use him as a running back. You can put him out of the boundary. Can give you stuff underneath. Can give you stuff down the field. Can use him as a running back, running off tackle at times. He's going to be a fun player to see where he ends up. So those two guys, I think, are the ones I've been really excited about in the past week or so. But what about you?
Yeah, I've got two guys myself in the past couple of weeks. One of them I talked about on the Scout Talk podcast, which is left guard Solomon Kinley of Georgia, who is a huge guard with quick feet. I've kind of equated it to that if you've ever seen disaster videos where you see floods and you see how the current carries off some sort of like large, you know, whether it's a car or a truck or a boulder down the river, and you see it moving at an ungodly speed, and it doesn't look like it's going that fast unless you're in the water and there's no way that anyone's going to be able to avoid it, and it just basically careens into something and destroys it through the current. That's Solomon Kinley coming off the line, heading towards a linebacker. Just unbelievable about how quick his feet are, how well he moves, and just how vicious he can be. And he has his head on a swivel all the time. And if anything, the worst thing about his game is he plays a little bit too much on his toes at times, and that can be taken advantage of with him. But that's about it. He manhandles people. And he's technically sound. He's great. Love him. The other guy isn't a well-known player. And he's a guy that kind of, you know, when people joke on Twitter with me about, you know, how I like guys like, you know, Boston Scott or Kareth White or, you know, or someone like that, who's like, you know, more the late round guys that I enjoy, who I bring up as, you know, possible surprises. Jonathan Ward, the running back out of Central Michigan. He's about 6'1", 190. Watch him run, and I'm not sure he has great burst or great speed. He's not extremely powerful, though he has a knack for when you watch him in between the tackles and he gets wrapped up and they gang tackle him. Next thing you know, he's like 10 yards down the field with the offensive line pushing him, and he seems to have a knack for staying upright and I've seen like at least 6 or 7 games so far where he's had a long push like this. But the best thing about his game is if you didn't know better, you'd think he was like Alan Hearns in his first 2 years at Jacksonville. And if you remember Alan Hearns in his first 2 years at Jacksonville before all the injuries hit, he was a massive surprise who could take a hit over the middle, who could win on fade routes, who won, in tight coverage and took hit after hit after hit and made fantastic plays in the intermediate and deep range of the field. And this guy's a running back, and I'm watching him do this. He's great hand-eye coordination. I think he has a shot to kind of give you what Austin Ekeler or James White give you in the passing game if the athletic ability is there. So I have a total crush on this guy. And if he doesn't have the athletic ability for the NFL, I think the CFL will be calling this man up, and he's going to be a star there.
Oh, I'm sure.
All right, so the big question. I'm just watching reruns of The Office, so who's the Dwight Schrute of the NFL?
I got to say, out of all the times we've done this show, this is the question that like vexed me the most. And we've had some interesting questions. We have some even interesting questions that are coming up. And I really wanted to – if Andrew Luck were still playing – I probably would have said Andrew Luck off the top, but since he's not, I'm going to go with Philip Rivers.
You got my answer.
Are you serious?
Knew you were going to say that. Oh, that's awesome. Me too. Yeah. Good.
I mean just because you see some of the like mannerisms, you see the way he acts on the field, you see the way he is off the field, on the sidelines. It's Philip Rivers for me, and it's not even something that I could like point to specifically and say, okay, like this would be a moment where you could almost picture Philip Rivers saying, you know, Battlestar Galactica. You could almost like envision him running after his cousin Moe's. You could, you know, always envision him like, you know, taking his business card and, you know, whiting out something and saying, you know, assistant quarterback coach, not assistant to the quarterback coach or something like that. But yeah, Philip Rivers just gives me that vibe. Why was he your pick?
Oh, perfect. I got lots of examples.
Okay.
Dwight goes to rescue Michael Scott, who stepped on the George Foreman grill and gets a concussion and still gets in the car and drives off. That's Philip Rivers playing on an ACL tear. Philip Rivers, talking all sorts of trash game after game after game, but in the big moment he always loses is basically him and his prank exchanges with Jim. Like he rarely wins the battle, but he has some really great battles with him. You know, that's him in the playoffs. You know, Philip Rivers, in terms of like, he looks awkward, he moves awkwardly, it's kind of like Dwight doing karate, but at the moment where you really need to see like somebody step up and do something incredible, Dwight's going to save the day, you know, and end up doing something like that. And at first you want to hate him for his trash talk, because you think in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, his career would have ended about 5 to 7 years ago, because defenders would have been like, yeah, let's just take this guy out. He's annoying. Like, it's not even funny. Like, we're just going to take out the legs, you know, and whatever. And I think that for him, you like Dwight, you wanted to hate him at first, but as the episodes continue to unfold, you just can't help but love him. Like you realize that deep down he's in his heart. Also, Dwight seems to get the ladies in the oddest ways, like in every show. And Philip Rivers has how many kids?
Enough to fill an office. I mean,
Yeah. I mean, he might as well have a farm, you know? Right. I mean, like, and he's built farmer strong. So he and Dwight from that standpoint, and he looks kind of goofy like Dwight too. So, I mean, add it all up. And I was like, I would have bet money that you would have said Philip Rivers, because I don't know how anyone else would look at Philip Rivers and have watched The Office and go, that's the Dwight Schrute of the NFL. Yeah. So,
wow. I'm glad we're on the same page there. Because like I said, this would vex. But yeah, Rivers. Makes sense.
That's the most satisfying question I've ever asked on this show.
There we go.
Because you answered it the way I thought anyone would. So, all right. So what receiver from the 2019 class would you want on your team?
So 2019, you mean this upcoming class, right? Or last year's class?
No, this particular – yeah, these guys who are rookies right now.
Okay. These guys who are rookies right now in the league.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that changes things because I was thinking about next year's class. So that was when I was sort of doing my draft, my
pre. You can give me that one.
No, I mean, why don't you go first and then give me a second to sort of recollect my thoughts.
That sounds good. All right. My guy's A.J. Brown. A.J. Brown has been the guy that I feel like the moment he got drafted, I thought this is going to be the most productive receiver this year for the rookies. And I don't know if he is, but he's up there right now and he's making a push. You just watch him and I feel like the comparison I've given for a while has been he's kind of like Magic Johnson early in his career with the Lakers. If Magic Johnson were a football player, because you could put A.J. Brown outside, you could put him in the slot, you could probably put him in H-back and he would be productive in all those positions because he can win on the edge. He can run excellent routes, you know, in terms of timing routes, but he's deadly over the middle. And he's someone that he can be unbelievably physical with you against press. But if you get him in space after the catch, good luck, because he's going to make the first man miss or break the first tackle or the second or the third. He has speed to burn, and watching him lately just torch people, I'm telling you, this guy in the next 1 to 2 years is going to be a top five receiver in the NFL. And if I could pick one player, it's this Anquan Boldin with speed that we have playing for the Tennessee Titans. I am thrilled about his prospects.
Okay. That's a very good answer. And, you know, A.J. Brown is probably somebody that should be on that list. I'm going to go with Terry McLaurin just because, you know, watching him early this year, watching him even now with Haskins, you know, you look at the vertical ability, you look at the change of gear, you look at sort of the nuanced route running that he's shown, you know, just in his first season as a National Football League player. I've just been very impressed with the things that he can do working downfield. And I think, you know, especially with the phrasing of this question, the guy from the class that you want on your team, and given the fact that my team couldn't find an offensive drive if they were handed the ball on the other team's 2-yard line right now, like, they need somebody that could work downfield. They need somebody that will stress a defense. They need somebody that isn't wearing number 11 or number 28, because all you have to do right now is double team Julian Edelman and put a defensive back on James White, and you've done your job as a defensive coordinator. And so if you could add Terry McLaurin to the Patriots offense right now, I would be overjoyed. So I'll go with him.
All right. Well, you know, I can detect a little bit of an edge in your voice as you're talking, as you've made kind of reference to your team. And I've got some chocolate covered walnuts here ready to just kind of, and you know, it's not popcorn, but you know, listen, I'll munch on these. I want to hear what's going on, because, you know, I've seen some things about the Patriots and the film stuff with the Bengals, and I haven't read all the details because I've been busy with a number of other matters in my life that have been a little bit more pressing. Thankfully, we're here today. So I'm wondering what you think of this. Is this film? Is this these latest allegations something that carries water, and that you believe there's actual maybe fire behind the smoke, or is this just a non-story? And if you want to add in the fact that, you know, where the direction of this team is going, you can talk about that too.
Yeah. And we might as well just burn a time out here, because yeah, we're going to need the extra time. Here's the thing. If you take New England at their face value, that this was an outside production company that didn't know the NFL rules. It was somebody they hadn't used before, and it was inadvertent what they did, and it's completely divorced from the football operations side of the shop. And they had cleared it with the Browns, but they didn't tell the Bengals, and they didn't tell the league. If you take them face value for that, in my opinion, again, this is just my opinion, again, as a dirty, filthy Patriots fan, they still screwed up. Because here's the thing. Anytime the New England Patriots stretch the boundaries of the rule book, whether maliciously or not, they're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. And when you have a history of pushing the boundaries of the rule book when it comes to filming the opposition sideline prior to games, you're certainly not going to get the benefit of the doubt. So if you are going to do this and it's completely above board and you have no malicious intent and you really are just filming this documentary, which, by the way, the Do Your Job series that they do on Patriots.com is fascinating. It is a thing that they do, and the production value has been great. You have to be completely transparent and above board, not just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. You tell the Bengals up front that you're doing this. You tell the league up front that you're doing this. You probably put it out in a tweet that you're going to be videoing some stuff. You have Robert Kraft do a video that plays at First Energy Stadium. Hi, I'm Robert Kraft from the Patriots. You probably all hate me. But by the way, we're filming this documentary in the press box. Like, you are completely open and honest about it. And that's if you take the New England Patriots at face value. But they're not going to get that. And so you do have to wonder, is there something more? And I don't want to be sitting here and saying that there could be, but given their history of pushing boundaries and pushing rule books, it's hard for me to accept their explanation at face value. And I understand that right now there are people that are pointing out the fact that you don't get anything these days from filming the opposition sideline. Well, maybe that's true, that you're doing it against the Bengals. Well, you know, again, it's the National Football League. You have to win as many games as you can. We've seen teams lay eggs before. We've seen this Patriots team struggling right now, coming off two straight losses. And so they're not going to get the benefit of the doubt from the league. They're not going to get the benefit of the doubt from 31 other fan bases. And from me, a Patriots fan, they're not getting the benefit of the doubt. So you put that together, I think, yeah, there's something here. And whether it's full on, you know, taping of signals and cheating, or they just didn't go about it the right way, remains to be seen. But either way, they've screwed up. Because like I was telling you before we started recording, you know, to use an analogy, if you have, you know, cheated on a spouse and you the marriage stays together, you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt the next time you go out and don't check in right away, or the next time you're out with the boys or the girls and you don't check in right away because of the patterns in the past. And you probably shouldn't get the benefit of the doubt. That's kind of where we're at with New England.
Well, I think that's a very reasoned explanation as to why you feel the way you do. And it's a very realistic one, even if it turns out to be nothing. You know,
yeah, I mean, so even if the 8 minutes of footage that they have, which, by the way, that's somewhat reasonable. Like, if you're shooting for B-roll for a documentary, like I saw a camera guy in the New England area who works for WBZ who said, when I was shooting for something on Patrice Bergeron, a hockey player, I shot 30 minutes of B-roll stuff for a 15-second clip. Like, you shoot a ton. Like, so that 8 minutes, like, people see that and they think, oh my gosh, that's a lot. Well, if it's 8 minutes of, like, real time, that could be like three plays. Like, you're going to shoot a lot of extra footage. But again, even if it was completely innocent, they still screwed up in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go now from what might be the most serious organization in the NFL to some that I would say maybe, you know, we include hot tubs and dog pounds and all sorts of other, you know, things that are kind of fun little amenities. And with this kind of a joke, a duck, a baker, and a gardener walk into a bar on biker night.
Oh boy.
Which one convinces the bikers to let them ride on one of their horses solo? Which one gets the free riding lesson? And which one gets strapped to, pardon my language, the bitch seat and taken to a remote place for a beatdown? I'm just using biker lingo. So, you know, that's all, that's all biker
lingo, people.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
All right. Again, vexed and vacillated on this one. I'm going to go with the one that gets the free riding lesson is the duck. Okay. And I liked him. When I studied him, not that I was going to go as far as to say that he was going to be a guy that could play right away or anything like that, but you see him against, I think it was Kennesaw State his junior year when Samford was in the playoffs, and he threw it like 67 times. It was one of those games when you're watching the cut up, you know, when you see a quarterback cut up that gets into like the 11 or 12 minute mark, you're like, oh, this is going to take a while, but okay. When you see a quarterback cut up that pushes like 35 minutes, you're like, well, I guess I get to clear off my week to watch this one. And that's what it was like, because he threw it like 67 times, but played well. Went into Florida State last year as an FCS school, and they hung with Florida State all because he was just onions from the pocket, man, for lack of a better phrase. And so I think the bikers will like them. They'll give him the lesson. The one they'll trust to ride the bike is the guy that looks like he belongs, and that's Gardner Minshew. Because let's face it, if those three guys walk into a biker bar, there's one you think it definitely belongs, and that's Gardner Minshew. So they're going to trust him on one of their horses alone, which leaves us with Baker. And the downfall of Baker and Baker 2.0, look, the insurance commercials are cute. I like them as a homeowner. You know, I like the scene where he's trying to figure out which fire alarm is chirping. As somebody that moved into a new house where seemingly every battery and every fire alarm was changed like exactly 2 years ago, right to when we moved in, I've spent many hours, many sleepless nights or in the middle of the night trying not to let the kids wake up like doing that. I identify with it. The bikers won't. They're not going to like that. So Baker gets the ride in the bitch seat.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on all three of those. Duck on the field. You definitely see, like, against the Browns, throw after throw after throw as he comes in there. He's willing to trust his receivers. He's willing to attack downfield. You just see the moxie with the kid in terms of the aggressiveness and desire. And I think that the bikers will admire the spirit in him and go, you might not quite be ready to ride, but we'll give you a lesson because we think you'll pick it up quickly. And, you know, we like you. Baker's the guy that they'll look at and go, you're a phony. You look like you want to be like one of us, but really you just want to make some money and you want attention and you don't really know who you are. You know, I think they're going to see him in that respect. That may not be really the true what I just said about Baker Mayfield, but I believe that's what their perception of him might be, is that, oh, like, you're going to be a rebel at first, but then when you make it, you're going to be like trying to be something else, you know? So I think that they're like, you just want attention, you know? So I think that's that. And he might annoy them. I think you're right about Gardner. I think Gardner, like, they'll look at him and go, oh, he does not give a damn. Like, he doesn't care. He is who he is. He's crazy. He's having a good time. And people respond to him. And he's the guy that, because to me, when Hugh Jackson, a bunch of old men talk about him like Baker, like he's a Pied Piper, to me, that was like some total bull crap. Like, that's just like, because they don't know, like, those guys couldn't, you know, to me, that's like, you know, when 50 plus year olds are, you know, like me, and really let's say 60 plus year olds, cause I'm going to give myself 10 years, hopefully, and I'm on Twitter too much and I might act more like a 15 year old, but you know, when the older folks start acting like they know what, like, gets people to respond of a younger generation, I don't trust 80% of them when they say that, because they're the same people who probably make the decisions on marketing commercials that go wrong and think that these people are going to, like, you know, carry over. And I don't think they will. So, and when you watch their games, I mean, I just think that, you know, Mayfield's perpetually late on certain throws. He gets a lot of excuses made for him. I don't think he's a good quarterback yet. I think he can be. There's a lot of things going on that may cloud the issue and he may get out of it, but he's getting strapped to that seat. Whereas I think with Gardner, he hasn't played as well as of late, but I still like what I see from his game. I still think he deserves another shot. And I think that, you kind of like who he is and know what he is, so that you can at least work with that.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of, like, players who are kind of who've struggled at the quarterback position or who weren't very good during their careers, let's talk about do-overs. If you could go back into time and change the development or path or environment of a quarterback, which quarterback would you travel back in time to help? Or if you're just feeling rather Grinch-like this December, who would you like to take and change it so that they end up a lot worse.
I'm going to go Grinch-like.
Whoa!
And yeah, usually I'm not known for being in the negative. I'm usually Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky, at least on the timeline. I suppress all the rage and the energy behind the scenes. But I'm going to go outwardly ragey here. And I've mentioned this quarterback before. And I remember when I talked about this quarterback in response to a different question on one of the first episodes we did of the show, I remember my mom pulling me aside when the next time I saw him. I was like, I didn't realize you hated that guy this much. Ben Roethlisberger. We're going to take Ben Roethlisberger and dump him on a team that didn't have some offensive talent around him, that didn't have a defense around him that they could rely on, didn't have a running game that he could rely on, that forced him to try to be the answer immediately. Because then you're going to see a guy, like we see with many other quarterbacks, do too much, get forced into bad situations, suffer from quicksand, and he's not going to be the Ben Roethlisberger that he is today. They're not going to win Super Bowls. He's not going to be a Super Bowl guy because I think he fell into the absolute ideal situation. They needed him to throw like 10, 15 times a game. They relied on their defense, and they bailed him out when he made mistakes. And that's the perfect environment for a good quarterback to develop. That's the perfect way for a young quarterback to start to thrive in the league and to then learn as he goes. But for somebody that doesn't like Ben Roethlisberger, that's where I'm going. So he's getting dropped on the Browns back when they were bad. And yeah, we're going to see how he handles it.
There you go. Gene Bramall is smiling somewhere right now. So I'm going to go with back in time to help a quarterback. And I can't believe I'm doing this because if you know me personally, you know the one team that I cannot stand the most. And if you're a new listener, you're going to be shocked because I know many of the people I've acquired as followers lately are because of the Drew Lock analysis I've done on Twitter. I cannot stand the Denver Broncos as a Cleveland Browns fan. So hopefully you'll look at that and go, he did a pretty balanced analysis of Drew Lock considering he hates the Broncos so much. So you understand that I do separate and compartmentalize here, but I would go back and I would change Jay Cutler's career because I think that Jay Cutler was an excellent talent who was tasked with having to try and do too much and not delegate enough and not play wisely. And the reason behind that is that, you know, getting a chance to talk with the Broncos former GM on his show with Brandon Thorne years ago, he talked about the decision to draft Cutler and then what happened when the team fired Mike Shanahan. Because when Mike Shanahan came in, Josh McDaniels got hired, and the first conversation ever with Jay Cutler, with his agent there, with the staff there, Broncos staff there, was Josh McDaniels on a phone, in, you know, speakerphone, reading Jay Cutler the Riot Act, cursing at him, allegedly basically saying how much he sucked as a player. This is after he had a Pro Bowl season and how far he had to go, but doing it in a sort of like, you know, animated, cartoonish Vince Lombardi sort of way, as if like this was going to somehow motivate Jay Cutler, when in fact what it did was Jay Cutler turned to his agent, turned to the GM, and said, "Get me out of here." Like literally at that moment. And from that moment, you know, they knew, the Broncos knew he had work to do. And they were working with him and gradually, incrementally putting him there. And he had made a Pro Bowl, even not being the complete player that he could have been. And they were getting him along that path. But when they shipped him to Chicago, it was under the premise that Chicago believed they had a complete quarterback who could be the guy and was fully developed. And because of that, Jay Cutler ended up in a cycle of situations where too much was put on him too soon. And you end up seeing him turn into the anti-hero of the NFL, who's basically cursing out coaches, looking like he doesn't care, just like completely, you know, angry about his entire situation and hating life at every moment in the NFL. And I think he could have been a much better player if he had the development track that he was on with Denver. And I would have turned back time and said, when the before Pat Bowlen hired Josh McDaniels, I would have done something, hopefully, to convince him that Josh McDaniels was not the guy. He belonged back in New England where Tom Brady could curse his ass out on the sideline every 5 minutes if he wanted to. And he can live in that environment and realize that that's his environment and it can stay in that little bubble and not have to, you know, spread that virus to other teams in the NFL.
There you go. Yeah. All very fair.
All right. So which struggling NFL team do you think is poised to be better in the in 2020?
You know, there are a number – I'm going to mention two teams and for partly similar reasons. And, you know, this is something that I've sort of been thinking about and something I might write about or at least talk about on my show. But the year two quarterback leap, you know, we've seen that a lot recently, whether it was, you know, this year with Lamar Jackson or some other quarterbacks previously, you know, Goff took a step forward in year two, for example. So I think there are two teams that look to be poised to make that leap. One is Arizona. You know, while he's faded in the past couple of weeks, I do like the direction that Kyler Murray and that offense was going, you know, and I think it is to be expected. There's going to be a fade at the end of the season. And we need to remember, and I try to bring this up as much as possible, when it comes to rookie quarterbacks, like when their regular season ends, they go into draft mode and draft prep mode basically nonstop until the draft, and they're on a team. It's like they've been going at it for a long time here. And for a lot of these guys, they're playing, you know, 14, 15, 16 games for the first time in their career. So there's going to be a regression at the end. And so I think Kyler Murray in Arizona is primed to have a much better year too. And I think the New York Giants, say what you want about Pat Shurmur, say what you want about Dave Gettleman, Daniel Jones, as much as I wasn't a fan of his, has seemed to be good enough to be in the National Football League. Good enough to be a starting quarterback in the National Football League. The idea that they would draft a quarterback early that was floated by, I think it was Todd McShay this week, I wouldn't get on board with that. I think there are other holes on this roster. And they're probably going to be sitting at two with a chance to draft, say, Chase Young, assuming that Joe Burrow goes one to Cincinnati. That instantly improves your defense, which is a big reason why they're struggling record-wise. They can't pressure opposing passers right now. So I think those two teams will have better 2020s than 2019s.
Wow. Okay. I like it. I'm gonna go with the Atlanta Falcons. And, you know, it's not because of their pattern of being good 1 year, horrible the next. It's more because watching this team, you had a young offensive line. They added some young players in Caleb McGarry and Chris Winstrom. Both guys got hurt and were gone for much of the year. And, of course, that team was going to struggle with its run game as a result of that. But watching Chris Lindstrom get his first start this past weekend, and I know it was the Panthers, and they don't have Kawan Short, they don't have Dontari Poe, and they're playing a 3-4, which is causing Luke Kuechly and Shaq Thompson basically to go unprotected, and you can run all over this team. They give up the most if you're a fantasy player, and I think this is where fantasy production can be helpful in giving you a gauge of how bad a team unit is. When the Panthers are the most generous team to running backs in fantasy points over the course of the year, that tells you the running game is pretty bad. And the Falcons look good. I mean, like Devonta Freeman looked like the Devonta Freeman that I think a lot of people expected him to come back if he were healthy. And it fit my idea of what I've seen from Freeman all year, except for the fact that Freeman has often had to do it at the line of scrimmage with no creases and having to try and create creases when there's multiple points of penetration. And this week he didn't have that, and he looked like the Devonta Freeman of old. Whether Freeman's the back, whether it's Ito Smith, Kadri Olison, or they draft a back, which I think is more likely, or two, I think this offensive line is going to be much better. They still have the firepower in the receiving game. Matt Ryan is still a quality quarterback. And I think this defense that also had a bunch of injuries, this Dan Quinn's going to survive this, and I think that this team is going to be better for it. And I'm happy for Dan Quinn if he survives this, because as rough as things were for him, it reinforces my belief that that their owner, Arthur Blank, is one of the best owners in football, and that he's going to be patient. He's going to ride the course through things, and that he's a real businessman, not the pretend ones that are often inheriting money or making it big on one business and somehow, work their way in an interesting way to getting a team. I think this is a guy who actually is playing chess when other owners are still stuck on playing checkers or having someone play checkers for them, until halfway through the game they hear from their buddy that those people aren't playing checkers right, and then they fire them. So that's my take, is Atlanta, I think, is going to be much better.
I think that's a good point about the owner too, because we do see in this sort of day and age, the like limited attention spans of fans, of owners, there's always a move to overreact. And I think the idea of keeping Quinn and just letting him do his job is a great point.
Yeah. Let me tell you something. I live in Atlanta. I grew up when Home Depot started to become big. I worked for a guy who was an upper management in Home Depot before he decided to leave that company after Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus were there. Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus started this company from scratch. And there was a point in that development where the clerks, the people who worked on the floor, were making as much money as middle management, that they were literally in asking those two to be walked down the aisle at weddings. And they've done that. Like, wow. they were beloved. And you're not beloved because you're making a lot of money, and you're beloved because your company's successful and you feel like you're being treated fairly. And you have to be respected too, because if your company's not, if you're not respected, but you're liked, your company's not going to do well. So, to me, and then the one story I'll just add real quick, is just as a tangent of this, is I listened to Arthur Blank speak about his first year with the Falcons and how that they used to have a training camp, at Furman University every summer. And this is where the Smith family used to have it all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was basically like a plantation system. Okay. That's the best way that I would put it, is because the owner, Furman, old Southern school, and I'm not saying that they're racist or anything like that when I make that reference, I'm just kind of saying that it was more like, they had the big house for the rich people, and there were lots of servants. And I think they viewed football players as servants. And this was a venue for them to be able to just kind of, and when they went to camp, the owners got to stay at the president's house and the players stayed in dorms. Well, that's how it always had been. So Arthur Blank comes and they give him the tour and they're like, yeah, you're going to stay here. Isn't that nice? Isn't this nice? Look at the amenity you're going to have here. Playing the whole expectation of the spoiled NFL owner who really doesn't give a crap about his players other than just saying that at face value. They just want to be seen and enjoy the luxuries of life while they run a team and be fantasy owner. And who cares really about the team unless people complain and there's a PR problem. So this whole time that he's getting given this grand tour, he keeps asking the guy, well, when am I going to get to see where the players stay? And they're like, oh, don't worry about that. He's like, no, I want to see where the players stay. And finally they're like, okay. So they take him to the dorms and he walks around and looks and he's like, these mattresses are small. Like, how can a 300-pound player actually fit in these? And he's looking and there's a lot of mattresses on the floor, because the linemen, after doing their, after training camp, would have to sleep on the floor on an ill-fitting mattress in order to get a good night's sleep or a somewhat good night's sleep. Then he's looking around and he goes, these are the towels for the bathroom, like the towels. And he goes, these are like wash rags. How many towels do these guys going to need to actually dry off doing this? These ACs, they're like literally on top of the old style dorm rooms. And he's like, right. Yeah, this is the last year we're having this camp here. Like, how am I going to have players perform effectively and be ready if they can't even get a good night's sleep and dry themselves off properly after a shower? Like, that's ridiculous. And the fact that the people at, you know, at Furman were kind of like thinking that all he cared about was stuff that other owners cared about, that told me volumes about that. What he cared about first was the players and trying to like make sure that he cared about winning, and he cared about making sure that his players were at least got the minimums they needed to be able to function and not struggle through something that they're already struggling through. So, yeah. So I may not be a Falcons fan, but I'm a big fan of the Falcons owner, and I hope that he makes the right decision, you know, moving forward with them. All right. So just on the lighter side here, as I talked about, you know, I had my dark chocolate walnuts here, listening to you talk about the Patriots. What's the best snack resource for a football game? Potato chips, pretzels, nuts, popcorn, or tortilla chips, or something else?
This is, I could go Dwight Schrute and say beets. this is tough because I want to go potato chips, and I want to go with the Ruffles All Dressed from north of the border. They're fantastic. But the problem is, and this is probably a little bit too much information that people really don't want to hear about, but I have a very sensitive roof of my mouth. And so whenever I eat potato chips, and you know, what's the phrase? You can't eat just one. Whenever I like crush a bag of potato chips, I will wake up the next morning and the roof of my mouth is just like completely cut up. And that will go for potato chips, tortilla chips, sometimes even pretzels. And so while I love all of those things, I gotta be smart sometimes. As you get older, you have to take care of yourself. I love popcorn. I'm a big fan of smart food. Huge fan of smart food, the cheese popcorn, even lately the skinny pop. I like that. But I'm going to go with nuts. I like pretzels. I mean, not pretzels, excuse me, pistachios. I'm a big pistachios fan because it gives you something to do all the time. And there's nothing like if you got a TV timeout, sitting there, you're shelling them, you're unshelling them, taking them apart. You can do something with your hands as well. So, yeah. I'm going to go with pistachios.
So I can see it now. You're going to come down. We're going to do some sort of film project. And after that, and we're going to relax a little bit in front of the TV. And on one side, you know, on one couch is going to be Mark Schofield shelling some pistachios. On the other side is my wife, Alicia, with sunflower seeds. She is an inveterate sunflower seed eater. You'd think she was a baseball player.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She like a bag of sunflower seeds and a little plastic grocery bag for her to like put the shells in. And that's like all day long. She's like pretty much content right there. It cracks me up. So I like your answer, but I'm not going for health and like sense. Cause if I'm, you know, I try and do that during the week. If I'm going to like, I'm going to like eat any of this type of stuff nowadays, I'm just going all out because I mean, like, why? So it doesn't happen often, but I'll say pretzels because I'm thinking of it as a raw resource. Like, you know, what can you do with things? You can put chocolate over pretzels. You can get soft pretzels and use cheese. You can do cinnamon with pretzels. You can do a lot of stuff with pretzels. Peanut butter, you know, I mean, mustard, you know. So there's lots of things to make pretzels kind of like, you know, doable. And the fact that you kept saying pretzels is, you know, I'm going to take that as a Freudian slip. So I'm just going to add that as another convenient argument for why pretzels are the best snack resource. All right.
It's an ironclad argument, you know? I didn't even think about the soft pretzel angle because you get like the melted cheese dip. You could go like Dijon, a spicy brown mustard on a pretzel. That might change my thinking here.
See, I'm all about having the spicy brown mustard. And you know, I don't live anywhere where they make good pretzels, but I live by a Kroger that, like, I walked in the Kroger when we first moved. I walked into the Kroger. If for some reason you ever wanted to stalk me, and please don't, but like, if you ever want to stalk me, you will find me sometime after 11 p.m. at a Kroger, probably, like, because it seems to be the time when I need to go pick up something or get out of the house. And usually I'm just picking up nuts or some fruit or something, but occasionally I, you know, yeah, When I first went into the Kroger that was near here, you know, they had like a wine bar and all this kind of frou-frou-y stuff that made me laugh, that I was like, we must live in a nice neighborhood. But like, but they made fresh pretzels, and I was like, ooh, this could be kind of fun, you know? And they weren't like, they're not the pretzels you're going to get up north, but they were fun. So, all right. Who's the best slot receiver in the NFL, not playing in New England or New Orleans? Because I'm tired of hearing about how great Mike Thomas and Julian Edelman are. We know how great they are, and I never tire of watching them, but I don't want to talk about them.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Cole Beasley in Buffalo. And I thought his acquisition by Buffalo was one of the smartest acquisitions I saw a team make all offseason. I said it this offseason. I remember I was on the radio, I think either July 3rd or July 4th, up in Buffalo, and I said, look, Beasley is going to make Josh Allen a better quarterback. Because you look at Brian Daboll and his offensive influences over time, certainly the New England offense and the time he spent with the Patriots, you see what a slot receiver, like you just mentioned, Julian Edelman, can mean for a quarterback. When it's third and six and you got a guy that needs to get open quickly, you want somebody with short area quickness and change of direction ability. That's what Cole Breeze brings to this offense. And you saw it play out against Baltimore this week. They had a number of third downs where that's where Josh Allen was looking. And so when I remember when I was studying him, when he was on the Cowboys, he seemed to always be open. And so I'll say Cole Beasley.
I love that answer. I think that's a terrific answer. I'm going with Cooper Kupp, and mainly because I love the versatility that he brings. I think he's a fantastic route runner. I love what he does after the catch. He's a tough player. He can give you a little bit on the outside, so you get a little bit of unpredictability in terms of what you can do with him, a little more versatility in that regard. And I think that his career is continuing on an upward trajectory. So, when a grizzled defensive coordinator like Mike Zimmer basically says year one, when you have Sammy Watkins, Robert Woods, and a number and some other players, I remember if I recall correctly, and during a matchup, he said their best wide receiver is Cooper Kupp, and he was a rookie. That tells me all I need to know. I'm good with that. I'm going with him. All right.
No, that's a great answer.
So where do we go here? All right. So since we talked about the Patriots, we got to talk about the Browns, I guess. So what's wrong with Cleveland off the field?
I mean, it does seem like the situation is spiraling a bit out of control. Now people are speculating about Odell wanting out and telling Garoppolo, come get me, and things like that. I think it starts – well, I was just about to say it starts at the top with coaching, but I think you have to go beyond that. I think you have to go to ownership, because this is a situation in a franchise that doesn't seem to ever really get it right. And – you could almost analogize it to the situation here where I'm at in Washington, where until they fix the big problem, the overarching problem, whatever you do down below, whether it's player, personnel, coaching staff, it's not going to get fixed. And so I think it's an ownership level problem, not a coaching level problem, not a front office level problem. And I think that's the biggest glaring flaw with Cleveland right now, and will be until things ever change.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the coaching, I think that the ownership is out of their element, and that Seth Wickersham article, I think, has been proven fairly correct that this group is out of their element. Things just aren't set up well. And to me, the answer is that when you allow dysfunction to exist the way it did with Dorsey and Hugh Jackson and with Todd Haley, that's a problem, because you set up that structure and then you let it persist to the point that it got way out of control. So that tells me right there that you don't manage things tightly. And hey, if you want to say, well, they're new and they, you know, they didn't know what they're doing, I understand that. But when your Flying J franchises aren't being managed tightly either, and you're having issues with the FBI and the IRS or whoever they're, whatever, you know, government organization with three letters is investigating you, I think that tells you at best, they weren't managing that tightly either. So I look at the situation and I just don't think that they're equipped to make the decisions that need to be made in a timely enough basis that they're kind of loosey-goosey about how to make decisions, sticking with those decisions, who to listen to, who not to listen to. And as a result of that, and then micromanaging the wrong things, and then getting the perception that you're basically, you know, Gomer Pyle at Paris Island, you know, when it comes to being an owner. And if you don't know what I'm talking about there, then, you know, I understand, you know, okay, millennial, you know, or whatever, right. but I'm not a boomer. So I have fun making fun of both y'all, cause I can't stand some of those boomers. And honestly, I can't even stand this whole generational talk. There are a lot of great people from all ages who I just like people with sense. Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll just leave it at that. Cause there are plenty of people with sense who are older. There are plenty of people with sense who are younger.
Yep.
So, you know, yeah, I just think Cleveland needs a new owner. And you know, listen, if I win the Powerball 3 or 4 times, I'm coming for Cleveland. That's all I'm going to say.
There you go.
So where does Cam wind up?
I do think that he stays in Carolina. Tepper came out today. We're recording this on Wednesday and said, look, he wants his starting quarterback to be a healthy Cam Newton. So I do think that he stays. But if he does leave, there are a number of teams that you could say would be in the mix on him. You know, I think Chicago would be an intriguing option. You know, I look at some of the other teams around the league that might make some sense. But I'm going to say Tennessee. And obviously we know that Marcus Mariota – time in Tennessee, that experiment is over. He's going to find himself a new home. We can certainly say that Ryan Tannehill has played extremely well over the past couple of weeks, and he has, both from a film perspective and a numbers perspective. But I think if you're Tennessee, you have to still anticipate the eventual regression, the eventual return to form. Now, maybe this is who Ryan Tannehill was always supposed to be as a quarterback, and maybe he is that good and he got better and it was the Adam Gase influence that almost ruined him. But you have to hedge, right? But you have to hedge against that. And so you look at some of the athletes, some of the things that they can do offensively, some of the things they can do with Derrick Henry and company. I think a nice fit would be Cam Newton.
I like that. And I think that that's an absolutely awesome answer schematically when you have that big running game and just how fearsome that could be with a healthy Cam Newton and a Derrick Henry. My only fear is that a healthy Cam Newton might have been like 6 years ago as opposed to now. So I do worry about that. But what we do get from a Cam Newton now who's still on shakier health ground, I like the Chicago answer more because I think they have the makings of a good offensive line. I think that he does hang in the pocket like an anchor. I'd like to see Mitchell Trubisky get put out of his misery, even though he did play better last week. I think that Newton could be a really nice option for the receivers that they have there. So I wouldn't mind that, but that's more preference. Not so much where he does, because like you said, if Tepper says he's staying, then, or he'd like to see a healthy him stay, then I guess he will be winding up in Carolina. Speaking of marooned stars, which star would you like to rescue from their island of despair?
Yeah. From the island of misfit toys. I'm going to go with Jamal Adams from the Jets, the safety. And when it comes to just sitting down and watching players, regardless of position each week, Adams is one guy I always try to get a chance to watch. I love the way he plays the game. I love the way he plays the safety position. I love the versatility that he brings. The Jets seem like a mess right now. You've got Le'Veon Bell going bowling. You've got Adam Gase seemingly ruining that offense right now. They're losing to the Bengals. I want Jamal Adams. I mean, it doesn't matter, Patriots, any other team. Like, I would love to see him get a shot somewhere else. So I'll say Jamal Adams.
Okay. I like that. I'm going to say Leonard Fournette because when at first, you know, he was gangbusters his first year. Last year wasn't so good. And a lot of that could be blamed on his behavior and his preparation. This year, you know, he talked to his dad. He talked to Marcus Allen. He's like dealt with older pros. He's trained his butt off. And he went from being a ticking time bomb in terms of injuries and attitude to really being their best player, at least on offense. And he's really, if this team could have gotten into the red zone and been more effective in the red zone, he'd be the number one fan, running back in terms of production this year. I mean, the fact that he's been in the top five to top seven with his receiving skills that have improved. I mean, he was always a great ball catcher, but he's running routes now that you can look at and go, wow, he's running some routes that I haven't seen him ever run. And he's doing a really good job with that. And I just don't know if the Jaguars are ever going to figure things out. So I would like to see Leonard Fournette on a team that actually says, you know what? We know how to use you. We have the surrounding talent to make you a red zone just stud. And I think Leonard Fournette on a good team could be a 20 touchdown player. I think he's that kind of talent. I don't think he's the best running back in the league. I think he's one of those guys that you need a great fit for, but he's like just below the elite players, because if he could run zone better and had the physical abilities to run zone a little bit better than he does, he would be the best running back in football. But he's a little limited in that regard, but he's a heck of a receiver. He hits a crease like he's the best at hitting a crease, man. He's scary hitting a crease. And he's a powerful dude with great speed and good receiving skill. All right. Young player with talent who just can't catch a break.
2 weeks ago, we sat on Thanksgiving Eve and did a show. And it was then that I mentioned this player and said, look, I think the future is bright. I think that, he's going to get a chance in the coming weeks or so to really sort of prove himself. And since then, he ran a poor slant route and got benched and banished to Siberia against the Houston Texans. And that he caught what should have been a touchdown, but because of other earlier controversies, it was ruled out of bounds. And it was one of just two snaps he saw. And that's N'Keal Harry. I think he's a talented receiver who can come in and help an offense basically right away when you look at his ball-winning skills, the ability on the outside on the boundary. You look at the explosiveness after the catch, the fact that you can use him as a big slot player. But for whatever reason, he can't seem to really break into the Tom Brady circle of trust. For whatever reason, the Patriots aren't really involving him the way they should. And they're saying all the right things this week, like, oh, we got to get him involved more. But really, they're not. And he had what could have been a massive touchdown for New England in a critical game get ruled against him. And now he just is kind of languishing out there on an offense that needs help in the passing game. And so I think N'Keal Harry.
It's funny. My first answer was going to be Kiki QT because he seems, I think he has a real deep game that hasn't been exploited because of injuries. And it seems like he gets hurt just as he's starting to get a foothold. And then he had some issues with practicing and he was made inactive. And then he comes back and he fumbles, and so he's certainly a candidate. But then I started looking, thinking about a little bit more. And I think I might have the topper might be Matt Breida, because that guy cannot catch a break in terms of staying healthy. And if the old cheetah could stay healthy, he's by far the best running back on the 49ers. And I like Raheem Mostert. And I think Tevin Coleman's improved to the point that he is starter worthy on a team that wants to run more gap and use him as a receiver. He's kind of a less powerful Leonard Fournette, if you ask me. He's like Leonard Fournette without power. But you look at Matt Breida and wow, just like cutback ability, great vision, tough as nails, versatile, unbelievable speed, just runs things extremely well as a decision maker. I think if he were healthy, he'd be one of the 10 best running backs in football. I think he's that the kind of a talent, and I don't know if he'll ever catch a break because I don't know if he can stay healthy. All right, two more questions and we're done. Another food question, just for a fun little break here. Dog, brat, burger, pizza, or barbecue?
This one's impossible to answer. It really is impossible to answer. I don't think there's a wrong answer here. I will go with barbecue, mostly because, look, when it's done right, it's done phenomenally well. You get a bad dog, you get a bad burger, you get a bad pizza, like, it's going to be bad. You get, like, bad barbecue, and it's still pretty good. And especially, look, now I got myself the Traeger at the new house. You know, like I said, for Thanksgiving, we did the smoked mac and cheese. It was fantastic. I mean, did a brisket the other week, which was fantastic. So I'll go barbecue.
I think that's I like the answer. And, you know, you're right. When barbecue is at its best, it's unbelievable. It's one of the best things. But I will say, I've had my share of bad barbecue, and I don't feel that way the same way as you do about it. I would rather, but then again, you know, a bad dog, burger, or pizza is pretty darn bad. But the same thing, and I guess I would have to agree with you and say that bad barbecue's usually better than those things, but not so much so that I like look at it. So if I'm looking at like what I've enjoyed best, it's got to be a good brat. I think a good brat just does it. And especially with the types of things that you can add to it, and how you dress it up. And as I get older, smoked meats just don't do well by me. Like I can't eat smoked meat on a regular basis without feeling it later in the night. So, you know, things you can look forward to who are younger listeners, which is why I probably am more on a plant-based diet than I am a meat-based diet. I still need some meat right now, and I used to be solely plant-based for a long time, but I went a stretch of eating a lot of meat, and I'll tell you, barbecue, ooh, it's great, but it's a killer. All right. So last question. You need to throw the ball on one play, and you have to do it against the best cornerback in the NFL, whoever that is in your mind. Who's your target based on our current pool of NFL receivers or backs or tight ends?
Yeah. When you add in the current pool sort of qualifier, it makes it a bit tougher, because really what I want to say here is Shaquille O'Neal, because let's face it. I need somebody with massive size that my pop gun of an arm that I have attached to my right shoulder can deliver, okay? So I need somebody that's going to run a 5-yard hitch, but I can throw it like it's a 40-yard post, okay? So I wanted to say Shaquille O'Neal. But since that isn't an available option, I'm going to think about who's the best corner at football, and I'm going to say Stephon Gilmore. I'm going to say who's had some decent success against him recently, and I'm going to say DeAndre Hopkins. And so that's going to be my choice. If I need to complete a route against Stephon Gilmore, I'm calling on DeAndre Hopkins, who had some success against him the other night.
I'm right there with you, and that was my answer too, for similar reasons, because I probably have a much lesser arm than you probably do, and knowing that I need someone who's going to have to beat the crap out of the cornerback that he's facing and have a chance to win the ball, and he's not bothered by contact at the very least. DeAndre Hopkins to me is the perfect wide receiver in the sense, perfect NFL wide receiver in the sense that he knows how to get away with mugging a cornerback and making it look like the cornerback's mugging him. And to me, the NFL and really higher levels of play everywhere, I'm just being a realist, maybe a pragmatic sort of thinker here. Maybe even Machiavellian when I say this. Okay. It seems like in top professions are filled with sociopaths or psychopaths, and they don't mind cheating, and they seem to justify that they can basically, you know, they cheat until they get caught, and that's how the world is, and that's how you have success. We see it, unfortunately, possibly with the Patriots. We see it with Wall Street. We see it with corporations. We see it with our government, from any angle, local, state, federal, however, not picking on any one person. So, with that in mind, if you're going to, if that's how the world is from a Machiavellian standpoint, then, and that's, and whether you like it or not, then I want DeAndre Hopkins, because he's going to cheat like hell to get open and make it and do it in a way that he can, he knows all the ways to get away with it without getting called. And he's great at that. And then if you look at it from a more, you know, maybe just more realist or idealist scenario, you just say, you know, the NFL can't call everything. And part of it is that, you know, there is some give and take, and sometimes you want to let team play. There's points in the game where you want to let players play hard, because if you over officiate, you can insert yourself into the game in a way that's damaging and unintentionally create more problems than you should. And as a result of that, again, DeAndre Hopkins comes out on top, because again, if you let football players play, and I'm more on that end of it, honestly, than I am on the Machiavellian, but I just was feeling kind of grinchy. So that's grinchy. That's kind of how I see it. Yeah.
So I get it.
Hey, yeah. So listen, hopefully you're not feeling grinchy over the next, you know, 15 to 20 days. Hopefully you guys have a fantastic holiday. I know Mark and I might, depending on where we're at, you know, don't know guarantees, might decide that we want to do some sort of pre-holiday thing. And if we don't, it's because we're going to enjoy our families and enjoy that time and make that the priority and have a fun time with our holidays. We hope you do the same. You can rate and review the RSP cast at Matt Waltman's RSP cast on iTunes, Podbean, Google Play, Spotify, you know, pretty much any outlet that you get. And we would love to hear what you think of it. You can follow Mark Schofield at Mark Schofield on Twitter. Check out his Sco Show podcast, which is just a fantastic outlet. The work he does with Michael Kist on the Bleeding Green podcast. And I believe that's correct, right? That's the name.
That is correct. Oh,
good. And then, you know, of course, the fantastic articles he does at MattWaldmanRSP.com, where he breaks down quarterbacks in the pros and the quarterbacks who are soon to be pros. And of course, the RSP is available for pre-order in terms of getting your login for the 2020 RSP publication. It's available every April 1st since 2006. And you get the pre-draft version, which is usually somewhere between 800 and, well, it'll probably be between 800 and 1200 pages this year. It's been sometimes between 1100 and 1500 pages. In past years, you're not going to look at all that, but usually you're going to look at about 250 to 300 pages of just absolute draft goodness of skill players. In addition to that, you're going to get a post-draft version for you fantasy players that helps you get a cheat sheet and depth chart, you know, fits and analysis of that. That's just unbelievably helpful for fantasy players when it comes to those rookies. And you get 3 years worth of draft class rankings. And those are updated with a monthly newsletter from June through December. And so I highly recommend, you know, you give that a look. There's a video tour at MattWaldmanRSP.com. And as Mark Schofield would say on Twitter jokingly, please prevent him from being a lawyer. So, and one of the ways that you can do that to prevent him from going back to law school is you can get the RSP, because, hey, listen, you know, I love having Mark as a writer for the site and getting people in to say, hey, they do some pretty in-depth analysis there. Let's find out what this book's all about. So while Mark gets to show people that we do that kind of depth on a regular basis and allows, you know, and we have that kind of content up, it allows me to continue to do what I do behind the scenes with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication. So thank you again for everyone for listening. If you're still here listening to that part of it, and you guys have a great, great holiday.